If people have ideas, and they might, if you have something today, we can discuss it, and then you could hopefully get us some verbiage. But it looks like we would probably really need to have another meeting really quickly. We are done and basically abolished at the end of this month. At my other job, I get to have a forced vacation between Christmas and New Year's, which is fine with me, but I think the family likes that idea of forced vacation, going out of town someplace where we might actually see some warm events. So I think if you guys have some ideas right now, if we want to even talk about how we might see the final product, and if you have some ideas, we can just kind of chat about putting that together and then reiterate it when some other representatives or senators get here today.
Were you talking to me?
Well, we're talking to everybody.
Good. Okay. Because I was just kind of listening. I was listening in, and I would like to hear.
Yeah, until we have a quorum in here, we can't really officially get going on a meeting, but I think we can still start discussing. We've got enough membership here that I'd like to kind of get some ideas, some feels for what they thought the report said, what directions we might be thinking about. So rather than sit here and wait for people and then start that whole process, if we can get some activities flying right now, it'd be good with me. Neil, did you have something?
Yeah, I can start off some discussion here with the NBA has worked over the last couple of weeks to draft an objective proposal based on some of the feedback from Nell's report, and focusing on taking what we had from our previous funding model and adjusting that looking forward to see how we could still make those numbers and also make it a more equitable and keep Minnesota competitive. The basis of what our proposal or this proposal would have in there would be to reduce the dependency on the flight line property tax and potentially eliminate that from the current model. Because of the way it is used, it is a bit of a complicated formula, which I think we've had pretty much a unanimous decision that it's a difficult thing to put your finger on, and it's used as a backfill in the current funding model. And drive it more towards a focused fuel tax-based funding model. If we were to take specifically our current breakdown and just adjust that from the 0 to 50,000, 50 to 100, 150 to 200, and change that to a 5 cents per gallon up to 75 million, from 75 million to 150 million, it would go under the 2 cents per gallon. And from 150 to 300 million would go to 1 cent per gallon. If you're to make that adjustment based on the most recent years of fuel consumption, we would raise approximately $12.5 million towards the fund. The adjustment on the corporate fuel tax, or we'd call it general aviation jet aircraft, would move to 6 cents per gallon. That would generate about $3.85 million. And then the last thing, which along the recommendations of Nell, is to reduce the aircraft registration fees. We looked at a number of ways, but what we settled upon was a per-weight basis for aircraft. And if you want 50 cents per pound, all the registered aircraft that we had from 2006 would raise $1.95 million. So if you added the registration fees plus the 6 cents per gallon for GA jet aircraft, you'd have a total of $5.8 million to the fund in that group. Now, general aviation, the some 5,600 general aviation aircraft valued under $300,000, which currently pay $50 for registration fees, along with their avgas taxes, contribute around $500,000 per year. So that model with fuel tax, the change in the registration fees, and then the continual no changes to small general aviation aircraft to give you about $18.5 million based on the...
When you say general aviation aircraft, you mean aircraft that burn avgas?
Yeah, sorry. Thank you. That's what we'd be looking at.
And it's the aviation gasoline tax.
Correct.
Because GA jets will be under the, I believe, what you talked about for the fuel tax for... The changes in the funding.
The GA Jet would move that from the current 5 cents to 6 cents per gallon, and none of the GA Jet aircraft burners would ever reach or even be close to the refund amount, which would be 75 million gallons. Even as a total, they wouldn't be in that range. So it'd be a full 6 cents per gallon for all GA Jet aircraft.
And who was this proposal from?
This is from the MBA, the Minnesota Business Aviation Association.
I thought so. Okay.
Tracy, do you have any comments on that? Or did Neil, did you guys get that over to Northwest to take a look and give us their input on something like that as well?
No, this is just our latest rough draft and notes here from our most recent MBA meeting gathering, but we'd be certainly glad to put in a more readable summary here for obviously everybody in the committee to review fully the impact on their particular organizations and groups.
And that's what we're looking for, is to get some summary versions and look at how we might move the process ahead. But again, we're going to be on a real constrained time frame.
Yep.
Being we're already on the 8th of December, if we're going to try to get something done before Christmas. You guys are all up for the task, right? Just nod your head and smile. That works for me.
I know we looked at, in one particular area, obviously understanding the impact of the new Northwest Delta combination on what that would be in a large carrier, the majority carrier here out of MSP. And if you added that current model, the new combined Delta Airlines would actually contribute about $6.5 million total sum to the amount in there, which would be less than what's currently being contributed with flight property, airline flight property tax and fuel. So you'd have some strength and some reward in an organization keeping a large hub operation here. Where it's going to where it's going to hit an impact other carriers would be in the less than 75 million gallon total. So
what I think I heard was that, and this may be wrong, but if you're thinking about reducing the air flight property tax or eliminating it, which is somewhere around the $7 million total per year that all airlines pay, commercial airlines, is that right?
That's correct, 7.8.
And you're increasing it to $12.5 million on the fuel is what you see the revenue impact being. The increase on the fuel is all airlines, the commercial airlines, you're asking to pay $5 million more per year. Is that roughly where you were at, Neil?
We've taken the fuel plus the airline flight property tax and combine it into one fuel tax, fuel revenue.
I'm seeing that as a $5 million increase. Is that right for the commercial airlines, is where your proposal roughly comes out at?
I think it'd be a combination thereof, because we're obviously offsetting with the 6 cents per gallon in the general aviation jet burning.
Okay.
So that's going to be an increase.
We would definitely have to take a look at it. I mean, from Northwest perspective and combined Northwest Delta, I think I can say we've always been open to looking at changes, but we are very much under some significant cost constraints as well. And I would assume we'd want Minnesota to continue to be a very viable, competitive location.
Well, that's a good point. We've always talked about that, as we want to make sure that as we change some of these things around, and I think Nell's charts on some specifics were pretty easy to read, to understand some of those things and understand where we could change some things around and be more competitive with other states, but we do need to look at how we stay competitive, I guess, as a hub as well. So, other comments from that side of the table as I was looking?
I have one additional comment, Senator and representatives, which is I'm trying to get my arms around what the kind of objective is here. We've seen the report. We know that Minnesota, compared to other states, has some pretty significant dedicated funds to an aviation fund vis-a-vis other states. We also see a pretty heavy budget deficit that, very seriously is impacting Minnesota. Don't we need to kind of shore up the money in the fund to make sure it stays there rather than continuing to provide revenue sources to this fund so that they will continue to go elsewhere, which has happened twice in the history of this fund? And we don't know that just last legislative session whether those funds will ever come back to this aviation fund. So I at this point, I'm wrestling with when we're focusing on revenue, we don't know where these funds are going to go in this budget, nor do we necessarily have a tight focus on kind of the plan for these funds on a forward basis. It concerns me to just be focusing on the revenue side.
I can answer that from my perspective, and we'll let other people have input. Now, we need four to be a quorum, or three? Three is a quorum? Okay. Wanted to make sure on that, so we officially have a quorum, so we can officially start our meeting. So let's start the agenda that we need to do. We do need to approve the minutes from the November 11th meeting.
So moved.
Any discussion? All those in favor?
Aye.
All right. The minutes are approved. What we did start doing for Representative Beard and Representative Dill, we started talking a little bit, as long as so many others were here, about the report. And to kind of answer Tracy's question, from my perspective, is when we decided to move forward on the report, the budget was looking pretty good. Our aviation fund has been a pretty big target for monies to solve some financial problems. From my perspective, Minnesota's key to maintaining any kind of growth or coming out of some of these economic hardships is its aviation infrastructure. It's always been one of the things we've been proud of. And I'll take even Marvin Windows, northern Minnesota. Without an airport there, we probably wouldn't have the window manufacturing there. And that's kind of a key to some of our outstate communities and some of the successful businesses is the aviation infrastructure there. So when we heard anecdotal evidence, some of us about, and I guess it's not even so anecdotal from, like, I keep a plane at Anoka, and there was a number of people that do business, small businesses at Anoka that moved to Wisconsin. It's more than just our aviation costs or some other things in Minnesota we have as mandates for insurance that don't exist in other states. So there's other issues that come into play. But part of what I saw as the end game was to really analyze these things and see, are we doing good things in our aviation industry? And I can see a lot of that in Nell's report, that we are doing a lot of things good. We are very competitive with a lot of key states around the United States. So then further is, can we adjust some things? Can we change what maybe some CPAs are looking at and telling the CEO of a corporation, well, you're spending this much money on registration. And I think, Neil, you kind of hit that. If we can change some of that perception in terms of registration fees and things and make up for the difference somewhere else where we're still in the bounds of a competitive state. But quite honestly, some of the things that people look at and some of the line items make it seem like we're non-competitive. And I think that this report showed that we probably aren't, except that some of our fees are rather high on certain ends of the aviation. So I see the end game is trying to balance it out and look more appealing, but making sure that the aviation fund stays structurally there. Yes, there's plans on getting the money back. We have a lot of good projects around the state that need to move forward that actually it's great timing to move them forward when there's construction companies sitting idle. I think we can get some great bids for the jobs, and we need to get that money back and get those jobs moving in this economy. So that's what I see as kind of the overall end game, and I'll let others comment.
Well, another thing that's, I don't think from the House side, you know, that Representative Beard and I nearly fainted in the last hour of session when last year when we received the news without any input from anyone except the leadership and the governor. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that with the new change in administration, we don't have any money to match, if there is a match required. Some people are suggesting there might be $1 billion taken out of the Aviation Trust Fund and put into projects across the country in the next year. And if, you know, unless that's 100%, where do we get our match? And the only surefire way is to constitutionally dedicate it, and I don't know what the probability of passing that would be. It doesn't feel that good, you know, just thinking about the dynamics of it. But there, you know, I'm thinking about your point was well taken about Marvin Windows, but they would be like the mega star of rural aviation economic development, you don't have to go very far from Moore Road to find DeBerkwis Company. And there's an example of a town that completely revolves around a company that has to have an airport. It's up in Ray. Where's that? Big Falls or Big Fork?
Big Fork.
Big Fork. Yeah. And that's an example of real economic development, and they're still motoring up there. And there's many others. And I'm just worried about as you are and as many others are, about the long-term viability. The point that you brought up is, how are we going to assure that if we change the structure and we bring in the money, how do we know we don't get robbed?
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm really not for changing and bringing more money in. If we can accomplish getting more money, I'm not really for getting more money from the aviation community unless it's through things that are just not right. Maybe that's fractionals. But, if they're just going to take it, make the general fund be balanced with the money that came from aviation. So that's kind of my take on it.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I remember the genesis of this whole initiative was the anecdotal stories about registration fees on Part 91 and 135 aircraft in particular being onerously high in this state. And I think speaking for myself only, the hope I had was that we could somehow keep the airport fund revenue neutral but move the components around within the revenue sources that made up that fund. Doing that, though, I sensed, and I think others agreed, that we needed factual information about where those sources came from, what would respond if we raised the fuel tax a penny, or if we cut revenues cut the registration fee on 191 and 135 aircraft, how much would we have to make up somewhere else? I will just point out, I don't know that it is reflected in here, but since 2001, the State Department of Aeronautics has cut the airline property tax twice, and we have never touched the registration fees on aircraft, much to the disadvantage of some of our corporate operators. And I think whenever Representative Leader and I back in 2003 went to the aeronautics director at that time and said, how in the world did you end up with $18 million in the bank and not been able to spend it down? There was actually a reason that happened, and some of it had to do with the terrifically high registration fees and the fact that several companies had upgraded their jet fleets in the late 90s and early 2000s. And paid significant registration fees, more, I think, than aeronautics had contemplated coming into the fund, which created quite a bubble, a revenue bubble, if you will. And, of course, now we have just the opposite effect. Some of us are looking at registration fees as perhaps so high that they end up whipsawing us, where when it rains, it pours, and then whenever things slow down, people aren't buying jets. In particular, revenue really falls off in a hurry. Whereas operations are a little more immune to the huge swings in revenue streams, and that if we did something with fuel tax, operations are operations, yes, we'd see an increase or we'd see a decrease, but it wouldn't be nearly as wild as it would be with registration. And then, of course, what we're hoping for is the rising tide raises all boats kind of philosophy, that if registration fees do come down, more people base their planes here. That's good for everybody because more people get hired to work in Minnesota. And that, at the end of the day, is the end game we're after. Speaking for myself, that's the way I saw the genesis of this. I think that Ms. Smith raises a good point about sufficient revenues to the aeronautic department, but I see that as an additional topic because, again, we needed to have a serious discussion about how did we get such a surplus, was it indeed a surplus, and how much is really the need out there. The $15 million does need to come back at some point. I just don't see that happening this year, given the incredibly bizarre and almost unprecedented situation we find ourselves in. But I think if we can move our formulas around just within the aeronautics fund and keep the revenue stable, I will consider that a great victory. And if it has the benefit of increasing employment and activity on the 136 other airports in this state, that I would consider a huge win. And I'm grateful for Nell's work in actually giving us black and white real, live, empirical data. This is very helpful as we contemplate how to move ahead with this.
Other comments?
It's been fun.
Oh, go ahead, Nell.
Nell is there.
Good. I said it's been fun.
Good.
You know, a good project is one where everybody learns, and I know I've learned.
Okay.
Well, I found myself late last night wanting to use colored pens to start changing some scenarios on these, and I thought, well, I should have a couple of copies before I start marking everything up, going through things. Right.
Mr. Chair, I obviously share, let me start by saying I think when we started this, group started out, I think a priority that was expressed by all parties around the table was that we continue to maintain the integrity of the fund. I don't know that we've gotten to that point or we know how to do that as of yet, and that's a concern I have. When I look back to the tasks from the consultant group, one of the items was the adequacy of current sources of revenue for the state airports fund in airports in the state, and I'm not sure we've answered that question as of yet either. The report certainly is focused on the registration fees, and I think the data that the consultant has prepared is good data, and it shows where Minnesota falls out in relationship to that. And also, it gives us very good information on the fuel side of things, and in fact shows that Minnesota is more competitive from a fuel standpoint than the states, all the states surrounding us. The fuel taxes are higher in those states. So I'm not. My concern is this: we're going. There's a lot of information here. I think there's some questions that haven't been answered, I'm concerned about bringing forth recommendations. Understanding this group has a sunset on it, but I'm very concerned about this group bringing forth recommendations in the short time period that we have, and I don't know what our options are in that regard. But my number one concern, as I initially said, is that we maintain the integrity of the state airports fund. I think you hit it on the head. Is that fund does relate to jobs? There's been a couple examples of that, certainly in Duluth, Cirrus, and Monaco Air. You know, we depend on that fund to assist and make infrastructure improvements that are vital to their job growth in the community. So, those are just some of my initial comments.
And just to kind of go from there. In terms of, I guess, comments and things that would end up in the final report, the report still gives us a basis of things that can be used for a number of years to come in terms of legislation and direction we might go legislatively with changing these things. So we don't, to answer that question, we do not need to, you know, we could come to the conclusion as far as this group to tell us as legislators that based on the budget, based on not knowing the integrity of the fund, we could leave things as they are today. But I think we needed all this documentation. Well, I know we needed all this documentation in order to know any direction we might lean in the future. And for even MBAA to come up with recommendations without, in the absence of this report, it would be pretty tough to come up with any recommendations that might seek to make us competitive on any other end. So as I kind of answer your question, we don't need to do action right away. Harold.
Mr. Chairman, Representatives, the Council of Airports, obviously our concern is the physical, the infrastructure and the physical capability of the airports. And our biggest issue is just exactly what was expressed. There's no certainty of funding now out there. Mm-hmm. We have to have that, and we believe before you do any changes, you have to find a method of having certainty that these funds, because the biggest drawback to the commercial environment is you pay money and you see your assets go to something else. That is, to put it bluntly, offensive to people in aviation. Mm-hmm. You know, it's why'd I pay? It's bait and switch if you want to talk to that. So we have to find a way to provide that certainty before we change the fund. The second thing is you do have this uncertainty, and I heard it from my county commissioners last week. The counties and cities are very reluctant to invest in their airports now because they don't know their budget environment. Mm-hmm. Which you guys know better than they even do at this point. So before we do changes, we need to look at that. But I think you hit the point, and Brian did too. There's no mandate for us to recommend a change at this point. We have the data. We can use a measured process to develop answers, and the fuel is one. But Northwest Airlines, clearly, and we met with them last week to discuss that portion of their commitment to the community here and how we can solve that and certainty of service, because 9 of the airports are involved in the airline, and we're concerned about how it impacts them and what we do. So it's a, you know, it's multifaceted, and our recommendation from MCOA is take the report, study it, but don't make changes unless we have certainty of the funds going to aviation in the airports.
And is that something you will have in writing to us?
Yeah, we'll provide you a written report. Yeah.
Great.
Just pondering the certainty, absent a constitutional amendment, which I don't think we have a snowball's chance of getting passed,
right.
Although I think it has merit, still there's I can think of several other people. I don't want us to take it personally that they took $15 million here, because they took it from the contractors and the barbers and the railroads and the ports. And I mean, in this budget deal, there's almost exactly 1,000 different line items in the budget. Many of those are funded with what we call a user fee. And as the legislature, through our elected leadership or whatever, puts a budget together at the 11th hour, sometimes they do strange things, and they really irritate some constituencies. Not the least of which, this hadn't even been paid back whenever they took it, so they had to quick pay it back so they could take it again, which was the subject of another hearing, I know. So really, Mr. Chairman, I'm at a loss as to know how we can enforce the any statutory provision when the legislature giveth and the legislature taketh away. And you can finish the rest of that thought for yourself. But other than public pressure on our local elected officials, that we let people know that this is user fee money that's paid specifically for the airports, and the airports don't get general fund money. They don't. Occasionally we throw some bonding money at one of the carrier airports like we've done for Rochester, St. Cloud, or Duluth, but there's no general fund revenue that goes to the airports. And
right.
And I think that's our job, to raise a public stink about that, I guess, when it happens, or keep that kind of pressure on. It's political pressure. It's the law. We make it up. We can change it.
Well, I think you make a good point. And the key to people in this room and people interested in aviation is to keep that pressure on. And I'm going to use the past general election as a good example. There was a constitutional amendment passed on an increase in sales tax. We can argue whether we like the constitutional amendment part on that sales tax or not, but people basically came out and said, if we know where the money's going, we don't mind being part of that. And I think that is key here, is making elected people understand when it's visible and people think they know where something's going, we have to keep it there. As legislators, we can't keep taking money and putting it into the black hole of the general fund when people anticipate its use for something else, whether it is barbers, electricians, commerce department, realtors, builders, funds. And that's probably what scares me more about this budget deficit. The last budget deficit, we had tobacco money and other things that were huge funds we could borrow and use smoke and mirrors, if you will, to pay it back. We don't have those anymore. So this is real, and we need to change some structural things. But as we change those, we do have to protect the integrity of those things that people are paying for and have an expectation of what those funds go to. And it's incumbent upon all us in the room to make sure we're at the table or at those conversations when they go down, because that's how you lose it, is by not being there and not being vocal. And whoever did that showed up at the airports when the governor landed the day after he supposedly fixed everything, that was great. I applaud you all for being very vocal on that. That worked great. Representative Dill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I don't want you to take this as that I'm willing to do something on a wholesale basis, and I'm not really proposing it. I'm just expressing my thoughts. Is that I'm not opposed. I voted for the gas tax and the license plate tabs and all of those things, the very controversial bill that we had last session. I don't think that it's one of the things that would not bother me is to see an increase in the fuel tax, notwithstanding the problem that the airlines would face. Really, the fuel tax that we have now is not that, is certainly not very onerous, in my opinion. Now, you know, I don't fly a Gulfstream, but I got a 182. It burns 12 gallons an hour. If we doubled it, you know, it cost me 60 cents an hour. You know, I just had a cylinder overhauled at Bull Duck, and it was $980. You know, I mean, that's a pretty small amount of that. But I can tell you that absolutely without question, I'm not willing to do anything in any of these, registration, fuel tax, a change in how the airlines are charged. I'm not willing to change for the property tax system, nothing, until those things are assured that we will have use of them in the coming years and for future generations. Because and I think, Brian, that's what you said, is that there is some room for some adjustment, but not until we have some assurance that we don't get bait and switched, as Harold said. And I'm willing to do a constitutional amendment with Representative Beard. I'm willing to do it, and I'm more than happy to do it. And I serve on the tax committee. It probably would end up there because of the because taxes. But I have to agree. I don't think that we really have much of a chance in passing it. I had a question for Mr. Workman. What is our balance now in the fund for the GA airports? You know, is it nothing? Is it? I don't know the number on that. Do you have a kind of a flying figure on that one that we don't hold you to?
Well, then I, Mr. Chair, Representative Deal, I could come up with just about any number then.
Well, I guess my feeling is I'd like to see it all spent.
I'm looking out the audience and checking to see if either Peter Buchan or Dick Tyson would have a better guess than I. I think the fund balance at the end of this year should be about $6 million. If that's what our forecast is.
And if that money, Mr. Chair, if that money is encumbered through a grant contract, then can the governor unallot those contracts and take the money?
Remember, the $15 million was taken out of this year's fund, so we don't have a lot of, other than our operating costs and the nav aids and some of that stuff, that money would be free balance. It wouldn't be encumbered by projects or anything.
I think myself, I'd like to have a better understanding of how that works at some point before we get too deep into particularly the last week of session.
Yeah, Mr. Chair and representatives, one of my concerns is with all the uncertainty of funds at the state and national and local level, it just makes me a little nervous to start making a lot of changes, because the proposal that MBAA put together is changing almost every portion of the funding, and I'm not sure I don't know what the economy is going to do to fuel. I don't know what the consolidation or the merger of Delta and Northwest is going to do to the revenue that the state is going to collect. I don't know what the registration situation is going to be. We know that there's planes that are not being registered currently, and they're sitting, you know. And so we're proposing making changes in all facets of the revenue sources streams, and I just feel that there's an awful lot of uncertainty, and I'm not sure we can predict what's going to happen when we make those changes. And certainly we don't know what's going to happen to even the current system.
Ray, you have something?
This is just for, Mr. Chairman, members, going back to the getting the $15 million back, in our discussions we've had with some of the legislators and with some of the administration, we get sympathy when we talk about integrity of the fund, using the trust fund for the purposes intended. But what seems to catch their attention is when we talk about the snapshot on July 1st of this year, where there was $9.3 million worth of projects ready to go, that was leveraging $32 million worth of construction. And in the economic multiplier on that, we've talked with Department of Management and Budget, and they agreed that multiplier effect of 2 is quite conservative. Roughly, on a construction project, very roughly, maybe half of that's labor, half of that's material. The labor turns over several times in the state before it leaves the state, and while it's turning over, there's the individual, corporate, and sales taxes that are paid on that, and that money does not go back into the state airports fund. It goes into the general fund. So when $15 million was taken from the state airports fund, put into the general fund, the net increase in the general fund was several million dollars less than the $15 million transferred.
Wow. That's a good point.
Help us make that point again whenever we're asking for the
$15 million
back. Harold? Mr. Chairman, and Ray's right about that multiplier and the way it goes. We looked at that, and that is it. But one of the problems we have right now, and I'll go back to the meetings I had this week with my county and everybody, the local match for these projects, if we were to put them back now, is in question at a lot of places. I mean, you get to our counties up north. We're talking about really serious layoffs and stuff now in the county levels and stuff. So they're not looking for projects. So I'd be careful with the – we may have lost those projects permanently, you know, in a lot of cases, because the communities are not going to be able to fund local share. And that goes back to, I think, the discussion on the stimulus. I think maybe, sir, you mentioned in that discussion that even 100%. If we got it, I mean, that's going to be tough.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm working on a project up in my district as a consultant, and that project is essentially on rails now. It's just on rails for 2010-2011. We had to go forward with appraisals and review appraisals and some surveying that's going to be in the very near future, like in the next 3 to 4 months. And when I got resistance from the city administrator, and this project has been ongoing for about 3 or 4 years. Yep. And they and the council and the citizens group that is supporting this have just been wonderful. And all of a sudden I got the resistance from the administrator, so I called the mayor. And he said, there's no way in hell that I'm putting 5% right into that airport, even for a small amount of money like the appraisal, the review appraisal, and the surveying, when I'm going to lay off a policeman.
Exactly right, sir.
And so
that's what we're hearing. Exactly right.
And I mean, I just saw it firsthand what you said, and it kind of troubles me because one of the people that has been a real impetus in this project is trying to locate a very significant manufacturing company in that community from China. And they can't, they have a corporate jet, and this person isn't going to fool around. If the airport isn't there, he's not going to locate it there. So I have that same fear. I mean, that's just in a little kind of a microcosm there of what's happening. And I just, in the case of Berquist, the IRRRB came in, of which I chair, and the board, and we came in with some matching money because the community didn't have the $150,000 to match. So we were able to find it from TAC. Luckily, they're in the taconite relief area, and luckily we had some mining taxes that we could turn loose up there. But this is going to become a real problem, particularly if there's any fooling around with the local government aid in this next, either between now and June 30th or in the next biennium.
Mitch.
Mr. Chairman, last meeting and quite a few meetings, we had quite a bit of consensus about the fractional ownerships and us missing that piece. And I thought at the last meeting we had discussed getting some possibilities from Ms. Stubbs on how we can capture that revenue. We all know gas tax is one. But I thought that we had heard that some other states had addressed the issue of fractionals and the possibility of how we would capture that revenue.
In my report.
Yep. It's on the task four there.
And it was, is it just the fuel tax? Is that the?
No. No, it's not just the fuel tax.
What page now is it?
You actually have a 60-day rule that if an aircraft is in your state for 60 days, they have to register an aircraft. It goes back to enforcement of the existing registration fees.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And also fuel taxes. They would be paying fuel taxes.
I have a question on that, Mr. Chairman. Is that 60 days continuous, or is that 60 days spread out over the course of a year?
60 days in the 12-month period in the fiscal year.
So better enforcement was your conclusion. But what is there specific legislation passed in other states? Are there other ideas out there?
Would you like me to give my report? Because it's actually the first two slides.
Yep. Perhaps a little discussion.
You have the slides in front of you. They're right there in front of you.
Yep. Should we go through the task force report? Yeah, let's do that now, Nell. That sounds great.
Okay. Okay, you've got the opening slide. I'm already clicking to the first slide that says how are fractionally owned aircraft taxed. And basically, I focused on the 13 states because that's where my responsibilities were. And only California and Texas have specific rules regarding fractional. California just recently, and that was meaning it was effective January 1 of 08, that for the fiscal year 08-09, that California would start imposing their personal property tax on fractionally owned aircraft. Texas, on the other hand, considers fractionally owned aircraft to be commercial aircraft, so therefore they exempt fractionally owned aircraft from the sales tax. However, their property tax will be imposed in the counties where there's strict enforcement, like Dallas County, Harrison County, very strong enforcement of personal property taxes. But remember that personal property taxes are not dedicated to aviation. They only go in the local funds. Okay? Next slide. Oops. But given that, several states do and could tax fractionally owned aircraft. Arizona, any aircraft who spends more than 90 days in a one-year period is subject to taxation as a non-resident at the rate of 0.1% of fair market value. Minnesota has a 60-day rule for aircraft registration, and it's any 60 days in a 12-month period. Iowa has a 30-day rule. So if you look at these 90, 60, and 30-day rules, several states do have the ability to tax fractionally owned aircraft. Several states also consider fractionally owned aircraft commercial aircraft, and if there's a commercial aircraft exemption in that state, then the fractionally owned aircraft would not be taxed.
Okay, we had a
Does
question.
That answer? Yes. Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, if I've read the statutes correctly, I think the 60-day provision pertains to non-residents. I don't think that pertains to residents.
Well, most fractionally owned aircraft are not residents of any state. In fact, most fractionally owned aircraft are residents either of Ohio or Texas. NetJets and Flight Options lobbied very effectively in the state of Ohio and basically now claim Ohio as the state of registration for those aircraft. Because not that they're hangared there, but they are scheduled out of there. So that's where they had the most nexus. FlexJets worked with the state of Texas, and Texas is their state of domicile. So all these fractionally owned aircraft are non-resident aircraft. If they are resident aircraft, they should be paying the registration fee anyway. So you get them one way or the other. If they're not resident, then 60 days, they owe the registration fee. If they are a resident, they owe the registration fee.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep. Any other questions? Or
I do have. Okay. Now, this is Mike Beard. Is there any state that taxes the owner of the fraction for their portion of the airplane?
Okay. The way it is handled is that the tax bill will go back to the fractional provider, the management company, and the management company passes that tax back on to the owners of the fractional interest.
Okay.
So my aircraft, I'm 1/16th owner or 1/8th owner of an airplane. My contract says that if any additional taxes or fees are due on this aircraft, it is still my responsibility to pay them. I am the registered owner of that aircraft. So it does get passed back to the owners of the fractional shares.
So, okay.
Go ahead.
To follow that on then, if Nell, if you were a Minnesota company and you bought an eighth of a jet then, or maybe this actually is for Gary Workman, that plane's here 73 days, 1 year, picking me up and taking me somewhere. Do I just pay my registration on my 1/8 ownership, or is the whole thing due and payable?
No. You're missing the point being missed here is that when I own a 1/8 share of N123XY, yeah, I have no idea where my aircraft is flying. So I don't register my aircraft in Minnesota. My aircraft is registered in Ohio, and the taxes are paid in Ohio. Now, wherever that aircraft goes, and it has nothing to do with me being on board the aircraft, it has to do with where does my aircraft go. So I own N123XY, but I never, ever fly on it. But yet it goes into California, and now it's going to owe property tax to California. So even though I never go to California, I owe tax because my aircraft that I have a registered interest in spent time in California. The tax is due on the airplane and where the airplane flies, not where myself, the owner, flies.
Zowie. I'm not sure you clarified that in my mind.
Well, you know, you have understanding fractional ownership. You know, I they sell pieces of it. I'm not focused on NetJets because everybody knows who NetJets is. NetJets can sell up to 16 shares of an aircraft. Okay, so it's up to 16 shares. I am a registered owner of this aircraft. Mm-hmm. NetJets says that these aircraft are owe taxes to Ohio. So the sales tax is owed to Ohio, and the registration fee is due to Ohio. So now I've registered my airplane in Ohio. Now my aircraft can be subject to taxation in other states because other states like Arizona, Minnesota, Iowa, Virginia, Texas, California, Missouri, will tax an aircraft just because it has spent time in that particular state. So that aircraft, the utilization of that aircraft in a particular state, will be subject to taxation. The tax bill will go back to the manager of that aircraft, and the manager of the aircraft will pass the tax bill on to the 16 registered owners of that aircraft.
Do we treat corporate airplanes this way? If there was a company in Ohio that flew up to Minnesota to see one of their factories in Albert Lea, say 70 times in 1 year, would Minnesota send them a tax bill?
Sure.
That goes back to the comment that Gary Workman made when I was there the last time. Yes, they should. However, there has to be enforcement to do that. In other words, you know, you have to be able to identify these aircraft and send a letter to them saying, we've noticed your aircraft in the state. We have no record of you paying registration fees to the state of Minnesota. Please show to us that this aircraft does not come into our state more than 60 times in a year, or send us your flight logs. And that's what Arizona does.
Wow.
High enforcement. And all it is you know, it's just maybe you see the aircraft, you see a regular flights coming in. Maybe they're coming in 3 or 4 times a year. You've noticed 3 or 4 flights in a year. You go, well, you know what? That's 3 or 4 times. Let's ask the question. And it's not a... it's not a nasty letter. It's more, we've seen your aircraft. We have this rule that states this. You know, can you prove to us that your aircraft has not been in the state more than 90 times or 60 times or 30, whatever?
Mr. Chair, to help simplify this, can we go back? Nell, could you go back to a situation where, say, I own an aircraft, I'm a resident of Minnesota, the aircraft only comes into the state 1 day for the year. Do I owe registration tax on that airport? And then there'll be a follow-on question to that.
The registration tax, state taxes are due in the state in which the aircraft is physically hangared. Not where the aircraft is registered. It's where the aircraft is hangared. And the reason I say that if I'm going to say my aircraft is registered in a Delaware LLC, but it's hangared, you know, in Duluth, Minnesota, the taxes are due in Duluth, Minnesota, because that's where the aircraft is hangared. Mm-hmm. So it's not where the aircraft is registered. It's where it's hangared. If I am a Minnesota resident, but I hangar my aircraft in Wisconsin, my taxes are due in Wisconsin, not in Minnesota.
Kerry, comment?
Mr. Chair, members, I think, if I recall correctly, if you are a Minnesota resident, that plane is in the state one day, you have to pay Minnesota registration fees. Regardless of where
you're
a resident of Minnesota.
I'm going to say it's more semantics. If you are a Minnesota resident and the aircraft is hangared in Wisconsin, the aircraft can come into Minnesota, but it can't come in more than 60 times. That's going to be a reading of the rule, but the bottom line is that there has not been very active enforcement of this registration fee for quite a while, I'm sure.
Well, Mr. Chairman, you ever picked at a hangnail and you don't know when to quit? I don't want to get in the way of the larger presentation here about airport funding. It appears, though, that fractional ownership, we could dedicate a couple meetings just to that. I'm sorry that I started to pick at that hangnail and everybody else has enthusiastically jumped on, but this is a touchy subject we may need to get our arms around. But I think understanding and solving that today doesn't help us with the rest of Neil's presentation. So unless there's a burning issue here that...
Right. Just a comment, and I agree with you, Representative Beard, but we do need to know what that impact would be before we bring forth any types of recommendations, in my mind.
And kind of on that vein, from Representative Beard, some of these other issues that are coming up that may not be directly addressed in the report, I think, are good meetings for our aviation subcommittee, airways, waterways, railways. We could deal with them as we're going through this process as well.
I have one question. Maybe this is for Mr. Workman or anyone that would like to answer. Who in Minnesota is enforcing this 60-day rule, and why would an FBO? I'm thinking of an FBO that I'm really familiar with. We have Simon Cowell coming in from Europe day after day after day in his Gulfstream. Why would we call the MnDOT and say they've been here 67 times this year and jeopardize us losing hundreds and hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of fuel sales? So what is the incentive for the airport manager to and there's others. There's a Russian 737 that comes in and takes 10,000 gallons every time he touches down. Why would we call the MnDOT or the Department of Revenue and tell them that one of our customers owes registration tax in Minnesota, other than we're just so generous up there and happy-go-lucky that we... But I'm thinking of the incentive for an FBO who was on the front line to do that. Is there any answer to that, or is there any enforcement of this at all in Minnesota? Maybe that's a better question.
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, to answer your first part of your question, was that's part of the problem of having to try to enforce, is trying to get a handle on who is coming into the state. And you're exactly right. FBOs and local airport managers don't want to discourage or treat their customers by informing on them to the state of Minnesota that we should be out there collecting their registration fees. We do have some pilots that are periodically will check some of the numbers, but we can't access the hangars, so it's become very difficult to search out for those who are not following the law.
And so, Mr. Chair, my question is, then, other states, is there any incentive, and do any other states actually enforce this?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
I can guarantee you that Arizona enforces their registration fee.
Well, Mr. Chair, that's because they have 7 months of nice warm weather, and nobody's going to give up 7 months of warm weather for a few bucks on a Gulfstream.
my personal opinion is that if you're not going to enforce a fee, why do you have it? So You know, if you're not going to, if there's no enforcement mechanism in place, you're certainly not collecting the revenues that are really due to the state on this fee. So, you know, maybe there's a consideration that maybe the registration fee isn't the best way to generate revenues.
Well, Ms. Chair.
Just a thought.
In those instances, an increased fuel tax would probably work better. Because then you wouldn't have the difficulty of worrying about whether it was 60 days or 90 or 35 or whatever. I mean, on those, particularly in those large sales, I mean, you'd actually, you know, get some real money out of it. And I'm, you know, I already said I'd pay more myself, but I mean, you know, I'm using 12 gallons an hour. It's not very, very illustrious. So, but it seemed like that we got some area there that we need to work on in this whole scheme of how we do this.
Yeah. Any other questions on that? All right, Nell, you can keep going. Thank you.
Okay, next slide has the title Michigan at the top. I was asked to find out what these Michigan bonds were, and I got hold of Mr. Robert Abent with the director of the program in Michigan. And in 2002, the Michigan legislature authorized the sale of $60 million in bonds to fund aviation infrastructure in Michigan over 5 years, hence the $12 million per year. The debt service on the bonds is funded through a parking tax centered on and around Detroit Metropolitan Airport. And that's what he said. That was his response.
Okay.
So that just answers that question. Airlines. I was asked to see if Minnesota is competitive on the taxing of airlines. I sent in my report here an attachment of how each one of the airlines is actually taxed. But to actually calculate the airline tax is insurmountable. There's just no way. I mean, you know, one airline has to calculate their taxes on their use in each aircraft. So, or each one of the programs. Sometimes the tax is due on the amount of time spent. Sometimes it's due on revenue miles. Sometimes it's due on the time spent. Every state has a little bit different twist on it. So I did attach a spreadsheet that shows how each of the states are taxing the airline. And you can see that only Arizona and Minnesota dedicate these revenues to an aviation trust fund of the states that were surveyed.
Okay.
Next slide. State tax changes. I started in 06 only because I wanted to make sure I got Michigan into the mix here, so I threw Michigan in here. I don't know that I need to read all of these. We can look at them if you have any questions. But Michigan does start the trend up there in the Midwest, the northern Midwest, of not applying their sales tax to parts and materials used non-resident aircraft as long as those non-resident aircraft are removed from the state within a certain number of days. In the case of Michigan, it's 15 days. And why would anybody do this? It's to encourage people to bring their aircraft to the state for jobs in the state. Keep jobs in the state. Maine, you know, came up with a 20-day rule. They also came up with a rule for aircraft that weigh more than 6,000 pounds and are on a 135 certificate not to be subject to tax in their state. Indiana came up with a flyaway exemption in January 1 of 07, again, within 30 days. For flyaway, and also if the work's being done, no sales and use taxes due on the aircraft if removed within 30 days. Illinois did the same thing. If the aircraft's in a state for pre-purchase inspection or post-sale customization, they're exempt if they're removed within 15 days. South Carolina had a sales tax increase. See, California started their personal property tax on fractional aircraft. Georgia went with a temporary exemption from sales tax on the sale of engines, parts, and equipment. They did it for 2 years. I would say they wanted to see if what everybody was trying to sell them actually was true. Maryland tax rate went up. Indiana had a tax rate increase. Indiana, new lease rule. Basically, some people were playing a game on lease payments, saying, well, you only have to pay X dollars, and it was far less than fair market value. So now the Indiana has come up with what they think is a fair market value for leases. Idaho had a fuel tax increase of one penny. Ohio now has a parts and materials an engine's sales tax exemption on aircraft that weigh more than 6,000 pounds. I do not understand why 6,000 pounds is such a milestone, but a lot of states use a 6,000-pound limit for exemptions. Iowa just increased their sales tax to 6%. Missouri eliminated sales tax on aircraft parts. They redefined commercial aircraft from 7 to 3,000 pounds. What that means is that any aircraft that weighs more than 3,000 pounds doesn't pay the full aircraft property tax to the state of Missouri. They only pay the property tax for the amount of time that aircraft spends over the state, and that applies to every aircraft, resident and non-resident. And they increase the cap on monies that can go into the trust fund. Colorado created a flyaway exemption. Flyaway exemption is an exemption whereby you can take delivery of the aircraft in a state, and as long as it's removed within so many days, there's no sales tax collected in that state. California had a 90-day rule that if you kept it out of the state for 90 days and used it during those 90 days, when you brought it back into the state on the 91st day, there was no sales tax due in California. It's been changed to 12 months. And Utah reduced their taxes. They used to have an aircraft registration fee or uniform fee of $5,000 to $10,000. It's now been reduced to $25 per year. Maintenance, I just wanted to bring this point home. Michigan, Indiana, Illinois, Georgia, Ohio, Missouri are six states that have passed legislation making it easier for non-residents to bring their aircraft into states and have work done without paying taxes to that state. This does not necessarily exempt them from taxes because they can bring them back into their own state, and that state may tax the work done in another state. That's usually enforced by the Department of Revenue. We did have some state legislation that failed. Massachusetts, New York, and Rhode Island, they have some exemptions that they were trying to revoke. They all failed. However, I just came back from a seminar, and my understanding is that all bets are off. All bets are off now. They're basically going to a blank table now. Everybody's going to have to justify these exemptions again. So 2009, 2010, going to be a couple of interesting years with regard to taxes on airplanes. And airplanes are getting a lot of attention, as we all know. Comparison of taxes. I was asked to do some comparisons to actually throw it out there and show how the tax... Again? General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford.
Oh, no, we were just noticing that their aircraft were very well noticed recently, yes.
Yes. Well, I had a call from several members of the press, and I basically told them after I gave them the straight answer to a question, when they started pushing, I said, when you start giving us more fair representation in the paper, I might be more willing to answer your questions.
To be a legislator.
Yeah.
My next life. So anyway, I did a comparison of taxes, and I did the Cirrus SR-22 and the Challenger 604, just to kind of give both ends of the spectrum as far as taxes. Yeah. Aircraft registration fees, personal property taxes, any of those types of taxes. When I did the comparison, Minnesota had the third highest, actually tied with Iowa. This is on the Cirrus SR-22, okay? Only Texas and California were higher, and they are the only two that have a personal property tax that is not dedicated to aviation. So of the states that have a registration fee, Minnesota and Iowa were the highest for an SR-22. Once the aircraft is owned for 7 years, this tax goes down. Then Minnesota is the fifth highest, actually the third highest, okay, without the personal property tax being considered. And here's kind of just a nice little graph that shows you the reason Iowa and Minnesota are tied is because that's the maximum registration fee is $2,500. It maxed out. Texas property tax, I had to make some assumptions. And California had to make some assumptions, but those are the property taxes. Arizona was about half of what the tax was in Iowa and Minnesota. So you can see at a glance how the taxes came out. Next slide, comparison of taxes. Challenger 604. Minnesota is the third highest Only Texas and California were higher, and remember, that's a personal property tax. So the states with registration fees, Minnesota's the highest. Once the aircraft is owned for 7 years, this tax goes down, and then Minnesota is behind Arizona, taking out Texas and California because they are property tax states. And you can see that here. Minnesota is $260,000, Arizona's half. That's the first year. That's a first-year tax. And there's the property taxes. Next slide is the comparison of taxes on sales and use taxes. Exemptions from sales and use. 7 of the surveyed states exempt aircraft that are operated under Part 135. That is commercial aviation, but it's the, you know, it's not 121, it's 135. So these 7 states exempt aircraft that are operated under 135. In these states, only the aircraft registration fees and personal property taxes are due or may be due. And in Texas, the property tax would be far less for an aircraft operated primarily under 135. Sale for resale, where you can, instead of paying the sales tax on the purchase price of the aircraft, but pay the use tax on lease payments, only Illinois and New York do not have a sale for resale for exemption. Iowa has one, but it is very, very restricted. So you have to know the rules in order to use the Iowa one. I mean, really know the rules. And here's kind of it's kind of mushy, but I had to get on one slide. It shows you the registration fees and property taxes and other fees, sales and use taxes on the one time, if you paid it on the purchase price, or if you did it on a sale for resale, the orange. So you can see going through here that Minnesota still is right there at the top, no matter which way I go. This is on the Cirrus. And then on the, here's the Cirrus Part 135. So this is Part 91, all the taxes that are due. Part 135, a lot of states dropped right out of the picture.
Nell.
But visual on this.
Go ahead, Neil.
I'm sorry.
Excuse me, Nell and Mr. Chair. Neil Brackman with the MBA. Just a comment on that. I know in regards to the large turbine aircraft, such as the Challenger 64, I mean, every operator that purchases one of those aircraft immediately looks at the total cost over the period of ownership, whether it's 5 years, 6 years, or 12 years or more for that aircraft. And your representations here, I agree, and they're very accurate in regards to what annual costs would be, with Minnesota being the third highest in both categories. But if you took the time value money and the total ownership, say for a 7 year period or anything more, Minnesota would not only stay in the top three, but it would surpass some of the property tax states, such as Texas, depending on use for that aircraft. So I just wanted to point that out, that although it does soften over time, if you look at the total cost over the time period of ownership, Minnesota has an extreme barrier to ownership for those aircraft.
It stays high. Here's the Challenger 604. California's the highest, but I expect that. California has a 1.1% of fair market value property tax. So it's always going to be higher because of their property tax. However, this is Part 91. If you go back in here, you'll notice that in California, all they have is a property tax, and there's no sales tax. So the sales tax is high, but there is no sales tax if the aircraft is operated under 135. So you go back in here, Arizona does not have a 135 exemption, but they do have a sale for resale. So I would go back down here, and then my annual taxes would be $174,000 if I was doing sale for resale. But if I paid the tax up front, it'd be almost $1.5 million. In Minnesota, if I did sale for resale, it would be about $202,000 per year. So I ran the tax rates on that. But you're right. It's that the Minnesota usually is right there at the top because they don't have the 135 exemption. So that's where I went back to my recommendations here, that Minnesota continues to rank in the top half of all taxes and fees imposed on general aviation. As far as the taxation on the airlines, I just want to make sure that it is difficult for me to determine, but I will. Is our representative from Northwest in the room?
Yes.
She's not. Is she there?
Yes.
I want to reiterate again that, you know, I have focused my energies on general aviation for 21 years. And for all these years, all I've ever heard is that, oh, the airlines are exempt, the airlines are exempt, and the airlines are exempt. Well, I've done numerous jobs right now recently where I've been looking at the airlines, and the airlines pay a lot of taxes. They may not pay what the general aviation aircraft are paying, but they do pay a lot of taxes. So I just want to, you know, let you know that I have a newfound appreciation for what the airlines are paying into the system.
Appreciate that.
And that comes from somebody who spent 21 years doing GA. Some areas you may want to take a look at that would make Minnesota a more friendly state to bring your aircraft. Look at creating a maintenance exemption similar to the surrounding states. I mean, Michigan, Indiana, Missouri, and Ohio are close by. Very easy to not bring my airplane to Minnesota. Reduced existing aircraft registration fee and enforce it. Look at exempting aircraft operated under Part 135 from the state sales and use tax. And the reason I would say that is that that's a sales tax. That's not any money that's going into your fund. That money goes into the general fund. And those are my three recommendations. And I'm finished.
All right. Thanks, Nell.
Okay, to kind of put the report on in a PowerPoint presentation, the final task four.
Yes, thank you. And that I like it in that visual format. It's easy to kind of, as I said last night, as I was thinking through after digesting it for a couple days, playing around with drawing different lines on it, and it was easier for me in terms of graph form to start kind of playing with some different scenarios. So I don't know if other people thought about that, but obviously MBAA did because they were playing with the different scenarios. Brian.
Mr. Chair, just one question for the consultant. How do we determine what that tax comparison is for the airlines? Because I think that's an important piece when we're comparing all the states with these other fees. Obviously, whether or not it goes into a dedicated aviation fund or not, I don't think is maybe as important. But if we're talking about looking at ways to spread the wealth, I think that's a important piece of it.
I think what was enlightening to me at the last meeting was hearing from the Northwest representative as to how much they're paying to each one of the states. Because she knows, because you have to calculate it, so you know how much is going in. You know how it's calculated. If Northwest is flying into all these states and having to pay taxes in all these states, that would be the best barometer to understand how much is being paid to the states.
Well, first off, does Northwest exist anymore now?
Absolutely.
Okay.
Have they changed the name yet? I didn't know they changed the name.
No, Northwest is a standalone, separate legal entity that will be operating for quite some time yet.
Well, that's good to hear, as I heard all these planes were going to get repainted and renamed. You know, Mitch might even know some things about that, because I know I was trying to understand when I first came to the legislature some of the, as I was told by Northwest what a raw deal they were getting, I started studying what they were paying at different hubs, and I know my head was spinning at all the different ways that taxes and fees were charged at different hubs. Can you shed any light on that at all, Mitch?
Mr. Chairman and members, if you're just comparing airport costs, it's not that difficult. There's a standard number out there called cost per in-plane passenger, and you add up all the different costs that are applied to the airline and divide it by the number of passengers that go through there. And that's whether it's a landing fee, a ramp rental, their gate lease space, all the fees together, and you come up with a standard term called cost per in-plane passenger, and you can do that comparison easy. I think where the difficulty is, and I think that Makoa saw this going into this study, was you got to get out and really see how much is the county taxing you on your hangar. Let's say, for instance, this is hypothetical, but Van's got a Masaba hangar up there where they're doing some maintenance. The county might waive all their property taxes and be happy to have them. And so there's no property taxes up there on their hangar. Whereas another county might say, no, we really need that revenue to offset it, and we're going to give you a lucrative lease on the airport fees, but we are going to charge you property taxes. So you have to go out almost and look at individual facilities and individual counties and cities and school districts to really know what they're paying, because otherwise you're not going to get the full grasp of it. So what we got here was GA's full grasp, but we didn't get any picture at all of the airline, state, county, and city taxes. But the airport piece, we could come up with that real easy and show you what the airport costs are.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I'll tell a story that I heard and let Mr. Workman react to it to see how accurate it is. But, you know, when we first got into this whole mess and when the first time the $15 million was taken from aeronautics, I said, explain to me where the revenue comes from. And there's basically three legs to the stool. There's registration fees, which are set, I believe, in statute. There's the fuel tax, which is, believe, set in statute. Then there's the airline flight line property tax, which is not exactly set in statute, the flight line property tax, which is not set in statute exactly. Now, let me, and I'm going to be running a little, probably a little beyond what I know here, but we're among friends, and you can all that every year, aeronautics, which used to be a cabinet-level position until about 1984, I believe, was charged with funding the aeronautical system in the state. And so they would say, well, here's how much we're getting from fuel. Here's how much we're getting from registration. And, oh, by the way, here's our building program for next year, so we need this much more. This will be the flight line property portion. And that number was sort of the shock absorber in the budget. And it was allocated over all the airlines, basically, and I'm speaking loosely here, loosely there was a formula that said how many seats moved through Minnesota with United or Allegheny or North Central or whoever it was, and they paid on some sort of a deal based on the number of seats that came through the air carrier airports. And that number kind of was never really set, but the airlines kind of went along with it because, oh, by the way, aeronautics did some pretty fine things with the air carrier airports around the state, like instrument landing systems and so on and so forth. And that's why that number, it was treated differently than fuel tax or registration fees. And that's why whenever the big carrier, hometown carrier, would get in trouble, aeronautics could adjust that number and just do it because the director of aeronautics had that statutory authority to set that number and then certify it through the Commissioner of Transportation to the Department of Revenue and so on and so forth. So that's kind of why nobody can really say exactly what it applies to. Does it cover baggage carts and tugs too, or is it just but anyhow, that's the story I've been told over coffee, not in a committee meeting, and I'll just share it with this group here just so you kind of know that there's a little more local color to that and why it may be harder to get our arms around just what we charge the airlines for that flight line property portion.
I pulled out my what I sent my qualification statement for, and it said that I was responsible for GA aircraft. Members of the task force may assemble state, county, and local taxes paid by the airlines in these states. Mm-hmm. I may be asked to review the documentation for accuracy and completeness. So, you know, I was really focusing on GA and trying to, you know, provide a comparison on how the different states mm-hmm. look to tax the airlines.
Mm-hmm. And I think you did a good job on what we asked you to do, Nell. We're mm-hmm. we're just kind of putting different things out there in terms of where we might go with polishing this job off.
I would like, you know, the other thing is that the Air Transport Association has zero information on how the states tax the airlines. They have absolutely no data collected anywhere on their website, nor can you call anybody at the ATA and get an answer.
Mr.
Airline Transport Association, the association that represents the airlines.
Mr. Chair and representatives, the one thing I did want to add about the airflight property tax is it's actually, of all the taxes and fees that commercial airlines pay, I think that one is relatively transparent. It's not necessarily easy to understand how we pay that tax because our aircraft are flying all over the place and we have some very sophisticated allocation methodologies. In addition, you've got, you know, states and feds and different types of tax. You have to keep different statistics about where your aircraft are in these different allocation methodologies because they're the last thing they are uniform. But actually, the airflight property tax, I think, has been pretty steady at $7.8 million for several years. It was a little higher than that 2001, it was $8.8 million. But then you've got very clear detail about what amount is paid by each airline in Minnesota to Minnesota. So that one, my perspective is that one's pretty transparent.
Do you have anything to add, Gary?
Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, I wasn't quite sure if there was a question in your statement or that you wanted me
to. No, there wasn't. By the way, this is how it was explained to me. And
I think that is correct. I mean, if you read the statute, it does say it's to make up the difference between. There are in the statute, in the tax laws, there are some specific things proportional to air cargo, to passengers and revenue that between what Northwest or the commercial airlines have expended in the state of Minnesota proportionally to their national thing. That's how they come up with how they distribute the tax. But the money does get set by the Department of Transportation, the Office of Aeronautics. There's been two, it looks like by early, like 97 to 2001, it was fairly uniform. Went down a little bit, and then since 2002, it's been approximately $7.8 million, and you're correct how it's done.
Other comments?
Mr. Chairman, Kevin Stolinski from Civil Air Patrol. Civil Air Patrol is in Minnesota Wing particularly is a nonprofit benevolent corporation by act of Congress. Missions of the Civil Air Patrol in the state of Minnesota, aerospace education, the cadet program, and emergency services. Our emergency services mission consists of search and rescue, which we do for the state, and it's a state responsibility, disaster relief, homeland security, and counter drug. The CAP resources provided to the state of Minnesota, we have 1,244 members at the present time, and we have 18 corporate aircraft in the state. These members and aircraft provide resources for Minnesota search and rescue. We have one Gibson GA-8, five Cessna 182s, and 12 Cessna 172s. Our aircraft are equipped with emergency locator beacons, beacon finding equipment, photo reconnaissance equipment, and advanced hyperspectral imaging system. In fiscal year 2008, we flew over 1,700 hours of Air Force-funded missions in the state of Minnesota and 2,200 hours of proficiency time. We brought in over $142,000 reimbursement from CAP and the Air Force, and $61,000 of that was fuel alone. The cost of Minnesota to duplicate these services would be in the millions of dollars. The state statute, Minnesota State Statute 360-55, which is exemptions to the taxes for the taxes for the Civil Air Patrol. In Subdivision 3, Civil Air Patrol, it exempts Civil Air Patrol from the taxes for the registration taxes. I would hope that anything that comes out of the process of this committee, this task force, and future things in this coming year that I can foresee that Civil Air Patrol doesn't have to bite the bullet over it, that i.e. what I'm saying is that you take into consideration the benefits of the state of Minnesota for Civil Air Patrol.
Thanks, Kevin. I believe I speak for the rest of the, at least the present company of legislators, that we agree with the Civil Air Patrol mission, and we do not want to mess with the potential impacts or ramifications that changing any of that might have on the mission.
Thank you, sir.
So, members, I guess the task as I see it is we kind of have two options. We can either accept the report as given, or we can try to add some comments. I'm kind of getting the feeling that we think the report is good, so I want you guys to be thinking in terms of, is there anything that we feel is incomplete? Because we could actually do stuff like the MBAA comments as comments to the legislators that are working on these issues. And we could accept the report and be done and not have to have any more meetings before Christmas. I think we are within the purview to be able to do that, aren't we? So that's really what I guess our mission is today, is for you all to decide, do we need more comments added in here? Do we think there's anything incomplete? Or do we think this is the task we asked for and we'll be able to keep this and use it as a great reference as we think about what directions we might want to head. Again, it seemed like more comments were we maybe ought to just dig our feet in the sand and try to protect what we have and be thinking about other directions, but I don't know. It's what the pleasure of the membership is here to get accomplished. I think it was a great job, Nell, on the report, and it gave me the tools I was looking for in order to have those comparisons as I look to the future of potential legislation on aviation in general.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair and members of the committee, and Nell, I think I agree the report was exactly as was requested. Had some fantastic information there and very valuable to any type of model that we would explore now or in the future. For me, the focus of this group was to study the funding model for the airports, the state airports fund. I know we got sidetracked 6 months ago with a curveball, but you know the committee and the groups within here rallied around that as well. And aside from the committee, have worked and you know my hero Gordon Hoff out there tirelessly setting up meetings and getting the word out and working with the airports and the rest of the members in here to assure the importance of that fund and to hold the integrity of that funding for future years. And that's been as yet to be, but it's looking towards a success as far as getting the information out there. But again, back to our task here was to look at the funding model in there, and nobody feels that's more important than the MBA is the integrity of that fund and the amount of dollars in that fund not only remain the same, but they grow so we can maintain the great system airports that we have in the state of Minnesota. Our members are all key users, not only base tenants, but throughout the state. We've seen through our own discussions in here throughout the year and now from Nell in comparison of surrounding states that fuel tax is an opportunity for us. And we need to be cognizant of large major carriers and cost per plane passenger, as Mr. Killian brought up, and also the state's FBOs in that this fuel tax is not limitless. There's a point where it becomes burdensome to the state, but it's certainly an opportunity area. Now, in the proposal that we have, and I'll proceed this by saying the MBA will provide and would like to have this within the committee, our proposal within the next 24 hours to every committee member here to review and to look at and to soak in. But fuel tax is an area that we can focus on. In addition, registration fees has been one of the keynote points that's been throughout this through this year, and Nell brought it up. Recommendation number two is to reduce that and to enforce the new law that would be in effect after this committee or after our recommendation. And we take that into account in our report and in our recommendation, which is to make it on a per-weight basis. Now, with the fuel tax and the per-weight basis, we're also capturing an opportunity area with the fractionals and Part 91 general aviation turbine aircraft outside the state that use our facilities. If they're paying a 6-cent fuel tax on everything they do out of here, they're going to be contributing to that fund. That happens if it's fractional or if it's owned independently or whatever it may be. In addition, a registration fee, you would, generally speaking, if you have the cost going down, people are more likely to participate in that than if the costs are burdensome. So we're going from an extremely burdensome registration fee to something that's much more acceptable, and people are not going to be looking to skirt that as much. So I think we have opportunities there that could help the fund in the future. And with regards to the flight property tax, I know it has been consistent if you look back, other than the reduction due to financial difficulties for the airlines in 2001, it has been consistent. But is it consistent because it's a backfill and we've consistently needed about that much? Or is it consistent because the model is consistent? We still don't know what the model really is on how we do this. Is it baggage carts? Is it gates? Is it airplanes? Who knows? You know, but it's always been consistent because we need a consistent backfill. So is it better for the funding model to rely on something like operations, as Representative Beard pointed out? Fuel and the consumption of fuel has been probably the most consistent contributor historically to this entire fund. Registration fees come up and down, and the flight property tax is always a continual backfill on that. So if our opportunity and the funding model we form going forward is on the most stable portion of that fund, I think that's in the best interest of the group and the state and everybody as a whole. So we take away the, not the flexibility or the ability for the flight property tax to fill in there. We can still have that to fill in there, but we reduce the dependency on needing that $7-8 million to continually backfill if we focus on operations and fuel tax and the most consistent contributor to this over time. So if we can accept some type of model or look at some type of model, then we can explore the opportunities that Nell's pointed out and we've discussed here with regards to enforcement. My colleague here brought up an idea of the fractionals and having a landing fee in there. I mean, whatever there be, some type of fee to, whether it's a registration fee or an operational fee for fractional owners, I would like to think that most of the Minnesota-based companies and or companies around the country, if we do have a registration fee system in place, they're going to be contributing to that fund, and we'd see that as it goes forward. But then the other areas in maintenance and developing the aviation and aerospace industry here in the state of Minnesota. So if we can get some tax exempt status to bring some more operations in and out of here and other opportunities that might present itself. So I think we have a core plan that works, that addresses a lot of the concerns of this committee, and then we've also been pointed out here through this meeting and through Nell's report in opportunity areas in the future.
Go ahead.
Well, I have a technical question. And I don't know exactly who's it from. Maybe Nell can answer it, maybe Mr. Workman, maybe someone from the tax committee staff. But do we have any authority to impose, whether it be corporate or fractional, the registration on foreign aircraft? You know, we've talked almost unilaterally today about aircraft from other states. But as I gave in my example at my wife's family's FBO, and I would suspect up in Duluth, you have a really significant number of foreign registered aircraft, mainly, I would say, from Europe, Saudi Arabia. And I'm wondering if we do have the tax and if we did enforce it, would we have any authority to charge those people that were domiciled in a foreign country? My feeling is I don't think we do. But who can answer that question, or is there an answer to that question?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, aircraft owned and used solely for the transaction of official business by representatives of foreign powers and federal government are exempt.
But what about privately, you know, corporate-owned or fractionals?
Well, it says for official business by representative of foreign powers or federal or state municipalities. Okay, corporations, I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm guessing, having read that once, only once, that we don't. Mm. You know, that sounds like when King Hussein comes, what used to come to Rochester to get his medical treatment, that's likely a foreign power. Mm. And, you know, that country would have may have been subject to the registration in Minnesota, but if some of the people that I mentioned earlier are routinely coming to Minnesota, I don't think we likely have any authority. But I just my question continues.
Representative Dill, I would think that would fall under federal authority as opposed to state authority because of a foreign
jurisdictional boundaries.
Mr. Chairman, one of the things that I hear it from my operator up there, that goes to that discussion, and that is, you know, for example, we see a lot of Canadian aircraft over. You know, we have no way to tax those. We can't force them. The Canadians charge for use of their airspace. That goes to that whole user fee argument, and that's how they collect the money for aircraft transiting into their state. So, you know, I think Director Workman's right that it would be a federal issue. I don't think we can do it locally.
Mr. Chair, going back then to your argument, the fuel tax would, you know, possibly be a way to mitigate that. And I'm not saying we need to raise it, you know, just wholesale raising it. That's not what I'm saying, but some kind of a maneuver that would start to take care of that. And then I had one more question about airlines, foreign airlines that come in, and Brian, you may know the answer to this, foreign airlines that come in and do business in Duluth or any other of our air carrier airports, are they subject to any tax if they exceed a threshold, registration or otherwise? Because I suspect that in Duluth you would have a number of foreign – you did used to have in years past a number of foreign carriers that would come and go from Duluth. Maybe they didn't break the 60-day rule, but I'm just wondering about that as well.
I don't know the answer to that, Representative Dill. I mean, obviously, they're subject to all our landing fees and gate fees and that type of revenue, but I'm not sure on the state side.
Mr. Chairman, for the purposes of moving things along here, I'm going to make a motion, and hopefully it'll pass, and we can wish her Merry Christmas, get her off the phone. But she's done the work we've asked her to do. I move that we accept her report with thanks and appreciation, and I guess that's my motion. I'll speak to it if it finds a second, which means I think that Dill has to second it because he's the only voting member.
That's a good motion.
Well, Mr. Chairman, if I can speak to the motion moment.
Go ahead.
On page 3 of the report that Nell just sent us, there's six letters here about what our task force resolution charged us with doing. I think that the consultant has given us facts and real data that we can use. As I just quickly looked at here, I think accomplished point C and point E, which is kind of what we asked her to do, and maybe to point F. A, B, D, I think that's our job, and I think we run out of time on having thorough discussions of the adequacy of current sources. I know we've talked about it. We keep bringing it up, but perhaps let's wait until legislative session and the aviation subcommittees. Hopefully we'll have one in the House this year, and we can join your colleagues in the Senate in actually having that discussion with staff that are paid to tell us about those things. The policy considerations about particularly sales tax revenue, which just goes into the general fund now. I know that's one that I'm very fond of. I know it has a snowball's chance this year, but at some point we need to start talking about whether or not we should dedicate sales tax from the general fund to aviation, which, of course, have a huge impact on all the other fees we already charge ourselves. How we allocate it and what we do, I think that's a legislative job that can come out of this report, and I'm very pleased to hear that NBAA has actually put pen to paper or fingers to keyboard or something like that and are presenting us a proposal that is a good starting point. Sometimes when a committee like this has a big task in front of it, it's kind of hard to find some place to push off from. So I tip my hat to our friends at NBAA for actually giving us a starting point and ask them not to take it personally if we modify it. We're not all of us salute, but at least you've run something up the flagpole, and I'm looking forward to receiving it. So I'd ask for a favorable vote on the motion to accept, receive with thanks. And I don't know that there's any other action this group can take at this time except to move into the next legislative session, and that would be a good starting point.
Well, and I'll comment on that as well, that I think Nell did the tasks we asked her, and we did have some other tasks. If you look at A, it's kind of interesting. The adequacy of current sources of revenue for the state airports fund and airports in the state, and we could argue that was all blown to heck with the absconding of the money, and that's really what we've had that discussion on before. We talked about that. Neil, you talked about that, and so it's hard to have a base of what's the adequacy when what you had there is gone in thin air. So, yes, members, I think that I do agree with Representative Beard that I believe Nell did everything we asked her to do in terms of the report, and that I think we should take that as the next step right now and then move on. We can thank Nell for her work if it's a positive vote and move on to the next. Do we try to do some other things here in terms of commenting on where our proposal should go, or do we just bring that in terms of to the legislation, aviation subcommittee, or lack thereof in the House, but actually move as groups and organizations towards an outcome as MBA is working towards on the aviation fund as well. So other comments? If not, we have a motion before us to accept the report from Nell. All those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. The motion is approved. Representative Dill.
Very much.
Yep. Thank you.
Thanks, Nell.
I had not thought of the explanation that Ray gave about the $15 million and the community impact and how. So what I'd like for you to do one more time, I think I followed it all the way through. I'd like for you to explain that, at least to me, one more time, because that really, I've been sitting here mulling that over, especially particularly with unemployment nearing 7%, almost everyone in my district, at least, that is a construction worker is unemployed, except for a couple of major projects in the mining industry that are very futuristic. And I just want to make sure I heard all of that again. That's some pretty interesting thinking on how you, I think you came to that conclusion. Could you do that one more time? And if you could suffer along with this explanation, I'd appreciate it.
Stock slower, Ray.
Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Dill, on July 1st, 2008, according to the snapshot that the Aeronautics Office presented to the Airways, Railways, Waterways Subcommittee hearing June 17th, there was $9.3 million worth of projects, state funding in projects ready to move ahead on July 1st. That $9.3 million was leveraging $32 million in construction. And very roughly, half of the cost of the construction is labor, half is materials. The labor turns over many times. Materials can maybe be local, such as aggregate, or it could be machinery from Japan, which would not turn over very often in the economy. But looking at that, talking to an economist, they felt that multiplier effect of two would be conservative for that type of use of the money. So we've got $32 million. Multiply that by two, that's $64 million. I just rounded it off to $60 million. So that money, as it's being used, there are individual corporate and sales taxes paid on that. All those taxes go into the general fund. So when $15 million was taken from the airports fund and put into the general fund and all these projects ceased, there was several million dollars less going into the general fund than there would have been in there if there was several million dollars left than the $15 million that was transferred as a net increase in the general fund.
So if the projects would prevail, there would have been more money in the general fund than there was just because we took the $15 million.
Not necessarily. There would be more. There would be less than the whatever the general fund balance was, plus $15 million, it would have been somewhere in between there, unless the multiplier effect was way up around 4 or 5, yeah. Then the amount in the general fund would have been less.
Okay. Other comments?
Right. Just a clarification, Mr. Chair. The recommendations contained in this report are the recommendations related to certain aspects of the overall tasks of the committee. I just wanted to clarify, these aren't necessarily the recommendations from the task force. Is that correct? And I agree. I think it would be useful for the committee to get Mr. Bracken's proposal and the opportunity for all parties to make comments on that. But as Ms. Stubbs indicated, I mean, she was tasked at really looking at the GA side of things, and that doesn't necessarily address the full gamut of the task here. And just right. Looking for some clarification there.
So, Greg, perhaps you could clarify. Since we're asked, or part of this could be to put our comments in on where we think, based on this report, things could head, do we need to have those comments in, or can we decide as a committee to do something else, I guess?
Mr. Chair, members, I'm Greg Kippinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. The report has made recommendations to the task force, and you've accepted those recommendations, but those are not necessarily recommendations that the task force wants to present to the legislature.
Okay, that's what I was looking for.
So though we've accepted the report, then we can come up with our own recommendation to the legislature, or we can say as a group today, no specific recommendation came out of the group, but we can then move other recommendations based on this report through the legislative process and committee hearings. So that would be our way of doing things. So we've We've accepted the report, so we're done with Nell. We next need to decide, do we want to then add comments or direction as a group for this report to go back to the legislature, or do we want to pursue direction directly legislatively based on the report?
Harold. Mr. Chairman, I think, again, I'll go back to what McCoa said at the beginning, is that I'd like to see the latter of your choices, the one that says we've got the data now, we take what Mr. Bracken's put together, we put all that together, and we take carry it over into a disciplined process through the legislature to look at it and make sure, one, we have certainty of funding, however we accomplish that, and two, that we have adequacy of funding. And I don't think that in the short time left for us that we could do that now responsibly on what we have. MBAA's proposal is very attractive, but we need to look at those.
Well, that's good comments, Harold, and that's kind of my thought process now is we've really got 2 weeks to digest comments, put them together, mm-hmm. and put them in the report or, we see you guys around here. We can put those actual comments to some great thought and come back with some proposed legislation through us that are up here and have the hearing process go through.
May I add an additional to that? That gives us the opportunity to educate the legislature. When we take those groups and you start putting it in, we count on you to get us to that point. We get into the various committees. This will give us an opportunity to educate them on an awful lot of the nuances that we've come across in this, whether it's how flight line real property tax is established or whether it's the authority that they're given and how that ends up not equaling what they need to spend. And we end up with residuals in there. That'll all be in that opportunity to do that. And that's part of creating that certainty of funding, too.
And just to comment to you, Neil, I think it sounds like a great proposal up front, but I think it's going to take more than 2 weeks to really digest it and get back some comments to know if that's the kind of thing we want to suggest. So my personal opinion is that we would move those into the legislative process and get some good feedback. Mike.
Mr. Chairman, maybe for Mr. Hubinger on process, resolution that established this task force, I think, asked for it to produce a report by a certain time.
Mr. Chair, Representative Baird, by December 31st.
Of this year. Mr. Chair, Mr. Hubinger, who's going to draft that report then and what's it going to say? And I'm going somewhere with this.
Okay. Mr. Chair, Representative Beard, that's somewhat unclear. LCC staff would probably work with Senate Counsel and House Research staff to assemble the report that your consultant has developed and perhaps at the direction of the chairs include other comments based on your discussions here. It'd be helpful if that report could be adopted by the full committee or task force. That might be difficult with the time constraints that you have.
Mr. Chair, if we were to adopt a report or a recommendation to the legislature, could everybody around this table vote on that? Or is it just the election certificate?
Mr. Chair and Representative Beard, the resolution creating the task force is explicit about the other members being non-voting.
Okay.
You as the members might want to still indicate the preferences of the members and report that. It just wouldn't be binding.
Well, I have an idea, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead.
That might help us bring some closure here. We've looked at the 6 points retained. This committee has retained Ms. Stubbs to do the report. We've accepted the report. On each of these issues, may I just suggest to the committee, and this is a starting point, so shoot at it if you need to, that we have discussed each of these points. I want to say something about accepting the recommendation put forward by the MBAA. I recommend it to the legislature that we pass it, forward it to the legislature without recommendation because we don't have time to discuss it. But we acknowledge their work, and we just move this task force just moves along without recommendation, which then lets the legislative committees actually begin to ruminate on it. And I'd also respectfully request that we add the issue of fractionals, how we treat them, that we request that the legislative committees responsible, examine that with an eye to bringing them into the revenue stream, but not doing it in a punitive fashion. That there is a problem out there, but if somebody flies in here 61 days and we're going to hit them with a $1.6 million tax bill just because they came here one more day, that does put us, put the people on the front line, like Representative Dill was mentioning, puts them in an untenable position. We don't want to do that. We'd like them to pay in the system. I'd ask that we make that one of our recommendations, that we don't solve the problem here, but we let the legislative committees responsible trim that hangnail, as it were, and put a stop to that. Maybe we have something, and I'm going to trust that the staff and the chairs of the committee will look at each of these A through F and make a pertinent comment as we recommend to the legislature that we move ahead with considering them. Also, the certainty or the sanctity of our revenue source, maybe we should make a reference to that. The users pay the fees with the expectation they'll be spent on the infrastructure that makes their activity possible. Does that sound good to everyone, Mr. Chair?
No.
Can we have a brief two or three paragraphs along those lines? And I would like to incorporate and recognize the work NBAA has put ahead, but I don't think it's fair that we pass it with a recommendation, and passing it without recommendation shouldn't be seen as negative, but shouldn't necessarily be seen as positive either. So.
Great. Mr. Chair, the LCC Legislative Coordinating Commission defines six duties, and I think as Representative Dill stated early on, that we should be looking at not just the revenues, how that's collected, but also the needs side. And item D, Delta, talks about the one of the duties being the projected needs of the future, including required investments in aviation infrastructure. So unless we know the needs side, we can't really define what the revenue side needs to be. So I guess that the formulation can be discussed, but that the absolute numbers being put forward should not be passed on to the legislature as recommendations. Mm-hmm. It's only the general means of or the methodology for collecting the revenues.
And members, what my thought process was is perhaps the two chairs could accept some comments from others, as well as, and part of that comment being the projected needs from aviation individuals, to add into the report, allow that report to be assembled, and then we'd still have to approve that before the end of the year. So, Mike.
When you're looking at the letter D and letter A there about adequacy and where the infrastructure is going, may I suggest that you don't make it a recommendation, but maybe make it an observation. Refer to the fact that it's moving fast. We frankly didn't have enough time to even begin discussing all of the needs that are out there. But mm-hmm. So rather than make a recommendation, make an observation and pump the ball back to the legislative committee to begin those kind of hearings there.
Well, I think within the cover letter, if you will, I don't know how we were going to put those paragraphs together, but to the legislature, you know, to state pretty explicitly on A that we discussed it, but in absence of the funds, once again, it was very difficult to have that discussion. So basically a lot of the things we've talked about, just kind of gel that out and put it into a cover letter format, and, you know, addressing that we were charged with these points, some of them such as A we couldn't get to the heart of because the funds were gone. And I don't know how you put that in a nice, I guess we want to be politically correct, but.
Well, we have staff, Mr. Chairman.
Yes. But I think that's the way to address a lot of these. That's exactly why we have staff, because some of us would just not put it in a very correct fashion. We'd put on the cowboy boots and go kick butt.
Mr. Chair, I agree with what I think you said, that, and I commend MBA for putting together an initial proposal, but it's. Whatever we present should include comments from the other parties after they've had a opportunity to digest that and comment on it.
So my thought process here is, for those members out here that would like to comment, that we have only a week from today to get those comments to both of us co-chairs. It's my idea that we'll look them over, and as long as they're put in a format that doesn't offend, we would accept those comments, put them in with the report, direct LCC to put them in the report, have that report compiled, and then is it possible to, well, let's see, then we would still have to have another meeting to accept that?
Mr. Chair, that would be the appropriate thing to do.
So, any options for a meeting that we can make sure we have a quorum and accept that report? Your thoughts?
Mr. Chairman, I'm in town, and if it's a brief meeting just to accept and approve the recommendation task force, I can make that happen anytime. But if I don't have to drive 400 miles like my colleague here.
Representative 520. No. It'll be a challenge, but you got Representative Lincheski that lives in town as well.
Yes.
So three of us.
It'll be a challenge between now and then.
Okay. An idea about how long, if we receive these comments within the next week, how long we might look at before the report to be assembled?
We could assemble the comments in several days. That would
okay.
Mr. Chair, what would be the possibility of actually in the very early part of session going to the Speaker and the Majority Leader and explaining that we need a few weeks in the next biennium to complete the report and to gather it and to have a meeting and ask them to pass an extension at the very beginning of session and that then sunset it at, you know, the first day of February in 2009?
Would you like to answer that? We expire before session starts, technically?
Yeah.
You do. And in addition, members, the LCC needs to be reappointed, and that sometimes takes several weeks into the session, and so they wouldn't be able to meet to reappoint this task force.
All right. Were the members, remind me, Ms. Juvinger, was the members, they were appointed by the Majority Leader and the Speaker, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Dill, that's correct.
Well, I'll be talking to the Speaker soon over another issue. I'll ask if there's a way to do that.
Okay. In the meantime, I think I'd be planning on one of the first days of Christmas week probably to hopefully get enough members to pass it.
We can all meet at Ann's house if we need to. No, we can't. You have to be there.
Right? Excuse me. I'm still on the phone here.
Oh.
Is it appropriate for me to be able to hang up now?
I guess I thought that when we said we were done with you that you did hang up. Nell, I am so sorry. We accepted your report. You were blessed to hang up. And have a wonderful Christmas. Thank you so much for your help.
You too. Happy holidays. Bye-bye.
I think I would just plan for that. So if members would be okay, we need another motion to that we allow the chairs to accept those comments.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that's an administrative matter and that you can operate that way, and we'd plan to work with you to schedule another meeting then.
All right. Is there any problems with what the two chairs are going to do? If not, I think our work is done for today, and we will try to assemble that report, and we'll get back to you ASAP on what we think the projection for having that report done, and I would like to plan on having it received before the 31st if possible, and if we can find out that we might be able to do something different, we'll move from there. So the meeting is adjourned. Thank you all very much.
Okay. No.